Have you heard about Global Poker? Global Poker is the fastest growing card room in the US today, and it's available online at globalpoker.com. Global Poker is a social poker site that offers safe and secure cash out options by using their unique and patented sweepstakes model. Players can compete in big guaranteed tournaments, jackpot sit and goes, or cash games featuring Hold'em, Omaha, and even Crazy Pineapple. Don't wait. Check out Global Poker today.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Hello and welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the Poker Authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 75, and it features Coeur d'Alene, Idaho's Dylan Lindy. Now, Dylan was a little bit late to the poker party, as he was 23 when he was first introduced to the game. Before that, he spent most of his time playing Magic the Gathering or other competitive video games. And then he started to take poker more seriously after watching his college buddy and fellow poker pro Kevin McPhee win at the tables. In the years since, Lindy has become a consistent force on the tournament circuit, with more than $4.1 million in live earnings to go along with another $6 million won online. Last December, Lindy picked up the biggest score of his career when he took down the WPT 5 Diamond World Poker Classic at Bellagio, topping a field of more than 1,000 players to earn $1.63 million. He also has a WSOP circuit ring, having won the Chicago main event in 2016 for $350,000. Lindy is also a poker coach who provides content for Run It Once, and he has a new poker book out by DMB Publishing. It's called Mastering Mixed Games: Winning Strategies for Draw, Stud, and Flop Games, and you can get it now on Amazon or dmbpoker.com. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here's my conversation with Dylan Lindy. All right, is there anything you don't want to talk about?
Not really.
You don't have any scandals.
Nah.
I had to ask that of Mike Matisau. Surprisingly, he said, I'm an open book. Ask me whatever you want.
I mean, if you read his book, it's all put in there. So, yeah. I have a great copy of it from my first WPT. Mm-hmm. That's just, my very first WPT I played, I was sat in between Phil and Mike.
What?
And I busted Mike.
No, we're starting the podcast now because this story is too good. Okay, so this is your first what?
My first WPT.
WPT.
Yeah, it was LAPC. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting between Helmuth and Mike. And
they had a special relationship.
Yeah, right. I didn't know what, I mean, obviously I'd watched a lot on TV, but I didn't know what the fuck I was in for. Oh, can't say that. I didn't know what I was in for.
You can say fuck, it's okay.
And I end up busting Mike by the end of the day, and Mike gives me a signed copy of his book that says, go fuck yourself, Mike. So then I had to read it, of course.
Yeah. What did you think of it?
It was very honest. I was shocked, really. Yeah. I mean, it's to just kind of lay yourself out like that, it's impressive,
I think. They don't build poker players like that these days. You don't see too many origin stories like that from the younger crowd.
No, and if you have that kind of story, then no one talks about it.
Exactly.
You know, I can think of a few players that have had some things, but I mean,
you certainly don't put it in print.
Yeah.
Let's get to your origin story. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I mean, Coeur d'Alene's pretty sleepy, you know, northern Idaho town. It's a lot of tourism, mm-hmm. big lake, a lot of, you know, outdoor activities, skiing and stuff. Not a lot of gambling. Actually, yeah. No gambling is legal in Idaho, but Spokane, Washington is next door. So there's a little bit of poker there.
Yeah.
All limit poker for the most part.
Well, what was young Dylan getting into?
All sorts of nerdery, you know.
Okay.
Video games, you know, hanging on the lake a lot.
Lake activities?
Yeah, like jet skiing, water skiing. I was a little spoiled when I was a kid, I guess. I had a boat.
Wow.
That was like one of those boats with the jet ski
motor.
Do you
mean your family had a boat?
Nah, I had a boat. Yeah.
Dylan had a boat?
Yeah.
What did you name this boat?
I think it just had my name on it.
The Dylan.
Yeah, I think it was just Dylan. which seemed kind of weird because it's just like Dylan and Dylan riding around on the boat.
Well, you know, it's like a child to label their toys. Just happen to have a very expensive one.
Exactly.
So what was mom and dad doing that you were able to buy this yacht and put your name on it?
My mom was in the car business.
Okay.
She owned a bunch of new car dealerships.
They call those the boats of the land.
That's right. Especially then. And especially North Idaho where everyone buys a gargantuan truck, you know.
Exactly. And what was dad doing?
Dad was a general contractor during that time. He did a lot of jobs during my childhood. But yeah, my mom made most of the money.
Any brothers or sisters?
I have one little sister. She's 7 years younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So during that time period, she was just jealous that I had a boat. She did.
But yeah, you had enough time to be an only child. You're a little spoiled and had all the attention for a bit and then came along little sis. Did that cause any problems?
Nah, not at all. We got along really well. I mean, you know, brother-sister things, but nothing.
Of course.
Nothing
bad. It's never going to be perfect.
Yeah, we've always been super close. My dad left when I was 16 and my sister was 10. Yeah. And so
16 is a rough age for dad to leave.
Yes. And I was just graduating high school and getting
ready
to go
to college. Almost a man.
Right. Exactly. Thought that I was, you know,
knew
everything and was responsible and super hot then. So they split as soon as I got to college. So it made my sister and I really close.
Mm-hmm. Did you just say that you went to college at 16?
Yes.
So what was that like? Were you... Did everyone know you as, that kid? That kid who was ahead a couple grades? That kid who was...
No, I mean, I went to University of San Diego. Most of, my two friends from my school that were my roommates, I don't know, they knew my age, but nobody thinks about it that way. It wasn't like I skipped grades. My birthday is in the cutoff date area, and my mom made me start early instead of being pushed a year.
Mm-hmm.
So no one really thought of it. And then certainly no one thought of it when I didn't go to a single class my first semester and just went to Tijuana and partied and, you know, didn't really do anything. Let's
say I went to college at 17 and it was the longest 6 months of my life. And that was just to turn 18. I felt bad being the youngin', you know, in my grade for sure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it hurts when everybody's approaching the, you know, like the 21 mark or the, like for Mexico, technically you're supposed to be 18 to get into play, but they don't
care. Yeah. If you're crossing the border, you're fine.
They don't care at all. So it was.
So what were you pretending to study?
Marine biology at first.
Okay.
I thought I was going to be Jacques Cousteau.
Okay. Had you had any experience in the deep seas or just the lake?
I've done a lot of fishing.
Boating.
Yeah. much different kind of boating.
You'd already spent a whole lifetime being a captain.
That's right. A lot of deep sea fishing as a kid. Did a lot of trips to the coast and, you know, a lot of reading on sea life and things like that. But, you know, little did I know, being a scientist actually entails a lot of looking at microorganisms and not swimming with dolphins. So that was a rude awakening, and I didn't like those
more classes. Microscopes than you'd think.
Yes, exactly. More plankton than octopi.
You mentioned video games were a thing. I read that you were a top Street Fighter player.
Tekken Tag player.
Oh.
Tekken Tag player.
That is not the same as Street Fighter.
I mean, very similar, but different games.
Well, it's going to ruin my next segment.
Oh,
because,
no. I did play a lot of Street Fighter.
Okay, good, good. So it's not quite ruined. I thought, what better way to get to know you than to take a quiz online of which Street Fighter character are you?
Oh, sick. Okay.
Yeah, I took one earlier. It was 50 questions long, and I ended up being a character I'd never even heard of. So we're not going to do that one. This one is only 8 questions. If there were a Street Fighter tournament in real life, would you sign up as a competitor? A, no, but I'd go watch the fights. B, yes, and I would walk home a champion. C, maybe as long as it's close by. And D, yes, although I probably won't last as long. Won't last long.
Probably C.
Okay. As long as it's close by. If it's convenient, you will enter the tournament
right.
And risk your life.
I'm old now, you know. My reaction time's a little bit slower.
Which Capcom series would you rather see make a comeback? Okami, Dino Crisis, Mega Man Legends, or Ghosts and Goblins?
Ooh. Ghosts and Goblins.
Okay, I never even heard of that. So we're going to get different results right away.
Maybe the hardest Nintendo game of all time.
Out of the following, what's your preferred fighting style? Boxing, jiu-jitsu, karate, or taekwondo?
Taekwondo.
Yeah? Do you have any experience in that?
No, I took karate when I was a kid for a little while, but not.
Just like the local.
It was like really vague. Mom. Yeah, just called karate.
Did you break a board?
No.
Oh, that's graduation day, I guess.
Yeah, you got to be. I think I got like a yellow belt, maybe.
I didn't
progress very far. No, it was like the second, I think.
There you go. If Street Fighter didn't exist, which fighting series would you be more inclined to play? Super Smash Bros., Tekken, Mortal Kombat, or The King of Fighters?
Oh, man. Between Super Smash Bros. And Tekken.
You said you were one of the best Tekken players.
I was a very good Tekken player, so we'll pick Tekken.
Yes. Be probably a pretty good Smash Bros. Player.
Pretty decent, yeah. Pretty decent.
Did I hear you won some money playing that game?
I did. Yeah, did some proxy. Some friends were gambling pretty high playing it, and I did some proxy playing.
How high? I mean, it's video games.
$1,000 a game escalating. You know how people are sometimes in the poker world. Like there's a lot of smack talking going on, and one of the guys that was gambling a lot was like fairly good, and then one of the guys who wanted to gamble couldn't play at all, but he wanted action, and I'd played quite a bit, so I just played for him.
You were the ringer.
Yes, exactly.
What was your cut of this?
Very small. I was pretty broke at the time. I was staying with some people who were very successful. So I was still like, you know, I couldn't afford to gamble very much on it. So I got like a small piece.
There you go. Which genre would you most like to see the next Street Fighter spinoff be? Third person action, old school RPG, a 2D platformer, or a mini game compilation?
Wow.
None of which would make any sense for that game.
No, they all sound like not great, but I don't think an RPG would work out very well.
Who would you rather have as a Street Fighter guest character? Frank West from The Dead Rising, Dante from Devil May Cry, Zero from Mega Man, or Phoenix Wright from Ace Attorney?
I played that Ace Attorney game a little bit on my phone. That was kind of funny. Yeah, let's go with Phoenix Wright. Although I think that it's crazy that I know this. I think that he is. Oh, I think both him and Zero are in a Capcom fighting game.
This is why this quiz is perfect for you. Where would you more likely go on a vacation? Europe, the United States, Japan, or I don't care as long as it's warm.
Japan.
Last question. What do you think would pull off the most convincing Hadouken? No, I'm sorry. Who do you think would pull off the most convincing Hadouken? Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Nicolas Cage, Keanu Reeves, or Chuck Norris?
Wow. That's strong. I'm going to go with Keanu. I could see John Wick firing a Hadouken off at some people after they came after his dog.
You are Jen.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know who that is?
No, he looks.
I thought you were a Street Fighter.
He looks like an. I played Street Fighter 2 Turbo, which was like the. That guy looks like he's probably a master, so I'll take it.
He looks experienced, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's like a Street Fighter expert in his car screaming about Jen.
He's like, Jen.
Jen is a character in Capcom's Street Fighter fighting game series. He was originally introduced in the 1987 original version. Whoa. And is returned for the Alpha series and Street Fighter 4 series.
Oh, the Street Fighter 1.
Chinese martial arts master and former assassin who uses legendary fighting techniques. I can't think of a better way to describe you.
That's pretty much my own story built into a video game character. It's wild.
I've always said you're the Jen of the poker world. What if it's Gene and we're just pronouncing it wrong?
Definitely could be.
All right. So you didn't learn poker until later in life. That's the weird thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Way later. I think I was 23 or 24.
So what were you doing all those years in college, if not studying to become I can't remember his name.
Rheumatologist?
I was going to try to make a reference to a movie, and I can't remember his name.
Steve Zolotow.
Steve Zissou.
Yeah. No, it said Steve Zolotow instead.
Steve Zolotow, great episode of this podcast. Make sure you check it out.
Vacillating between majors, went to, like, computer programming, which is the one I stuck with the longest. But mostly not going to class, playing competitive games. I played, like I said, I played competitive Tekken a lot, which involved a lot of study, really, because you study, like, they call it the frame data. So every frame is broke down into 60ths of a second. And so you would, like, find readouts of, like, how long each move takes in frames and then how much advantage or disadvantage on block so you could figure out. I mean, it's almost like, now that I think about it, it's almost like looking at, like, a PO output. Like, you figure out all these, you know, all these, like, optimal.
Do you have to stay balanced with your Tekken moves?
Sure, because if you throw out a move with, like, huge disadvantage, then you get punished super hard afterwards. So those are, like, your big gambles.
I think range takes a different meaning, though.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Quite different.
So, did college work out? Did you finish?
No.
So,
but I did spend 7 years there, so I could.
Wow, like most, a Van
most
Wilder.
Have doctorates. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But I think he finished eventually.
I can't remember. Did you run the school? Were you like known?
No. You have to
you
show up to classes.
You anonymously went there for 7 years?
Yes. You have to show up to many classes to become known. I think, like, I mean, I ended up being within maybe 20, 24 credits of graduating, I think. But, I mean, that was picking up, like, you know, I'd drop, like, 3 classes a semester and go to a couple I liked and fail some because of attendance. I played a lot of Magic the Gathering and video mm-hmm. games. I really, really just wasted a bunch of money in college. But I did meet Kevin McPhee, which launched me on poker. Him and I played Magic the Gathering, like, fairly seriously together. Yeah. We traveled around and, like...
This is EPT champion Kevin McPhee, exactly. Fellow poker player for those who have not looked it up yet.
Who's also from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, even mm-hmm. though we did not know each other growing up. We met in college at University of Idaho after I'd moved from San Diego.
Okay. You guys are the same age?
Yes, exactly the same age. His birthday was this month. And yeah, we
happy
were both
birthday,
born in
Kevin.
80. Happy birthday, Kevin. I'll be seeing him after this interview, actually. and then we just kind of found poker through advertising, like free $100 on Party Poker for depositing. Kevin had played a little bit in some home games.
Well, I read that, like, you guys went home basically for a winter break and you found out he had been crushing, so you basically said, I'm going to do that too.
Exactly. And then we just kind of started putting more time into that instead of Magic. We still played Magic pretty seriously for a while. I actually played my first pro tour after I'd already started playing poker for my living, so we were still somewhat into it.
But you knew this wasn't going to pay the bills.
Yeah, no, not at all. It's way too difficult. It's either the only way for it to pay the bills would be to, like, collect the cards and start, like, a marketplace or something like that. And that's just too difficult to do. There's already too much out there.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, made enough money to where it seemed like a very real possibility to do it.
What were you playing back then? Just low stakes cash, sit and goes? Or?
Yeah, low stakes, limit hold'em in the beginning and limit stud high. So just a lot of...
Those are two very interesting games to start with during the poker boom of no limit hold'em.
I know, right? We were also doing some, like, super short stacking at no limit cash games, like 6-max no limit. But it was, I mean, Kevin would remember what the number was. We'd always buy in for like $26.87 or something. So it would look like the last dollars in your account. So people would think you're like... punting it off or whatever, and so we would just like short stack and then hit and run.
That is exactly what I would think if I saw somebody buying for that amount.
Right.
That's crazy. I'm going to borrow that.
It was pretty good. At the time, it felt pretty genius. And we just did that for a while when Party Poker banned everybody in the U.S.
The UIGA.
Yes. They were the only site that really acted on it.
2006, 2007?
Yeah, I think so. 2006 seems about right. I guess we could go by whenever Ike got second in PCA, because I remember reading the story about all of his money getting locked.
That's definitely 2006. On NetTeller. Because I came into poker that year. UIGEA.
He was like the big story when NetTeller had everyone's funds frozen because he had a huge amount from that.
Yeah, it was 06.
Yeah,
so
then. And then we moved to PokerStars. And we were playing the biggest games on Party and Limit, which was like 5-10 or 10-20 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to PokerStars and thought that I was real hot shit and played like 20-40 and 30-60 and just got killed.
Yeah.
And so started playing lower again. And that's when I got into tournaments, was started playing the 180 mans on there. And then after I won a $20 180 man for $1,000, it was like, I imagine what you know, mainlining heroin for the first time is like. It's just like, oh, these tournament things.
Oh, the high yeah, tournament win. Woo!
Yeah. And no so looking back.
You were still in school at this point?
Not. Well, let's see. Yeah. I guess when UIGA first passed, yes. But after I got wrecked on Poker Stars, I was not in school anymore.
So what made you think, okay, I need to do poker? What was the score that led you to go, this is my starting bankroll, I'll be all right for a while? And
made about like 10K playing 5-10 and 10-20 limit. And mm-hmm. I was just like, I mean, this, especially in Idaho, like that seems like a lot of money. It was more money than I'd ever had.
Yeah.
And it was enough to like pay bills and do that. So I just thought, you know, this, if this is sustainable, I might as well not continue with school since I barely go to my classes. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like racking up student debt, not accomplishing anything with no direction. So I just decided to kind of put it on abeyance and see what happened with poker instead. And so that was probably, 2006.
You mentioned Kevin was your roommate. You've also had other poker roommates. Stephen Chidwick,
yes.
Elio Fox. How were they as roommates? How are poker players in general as roommates?
Most of them are pretty good. You know, Stevie was real funny because he started playing poker so early. He started playing poker in high school.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that he just didn't know how to do on his own because he, you know, just like basically lived with his parents and then moved out. But he was like, yeah, when Black Friday happened, I lived with Stephen Chidwick and John Van Fleet and another friend, Pat Moore.
Ape Styles. Yeah.
Pretty great few people to stay with, you know, a couple of beautiful human beings. And that's where I met Elio Fox. He lived in a house just down the street. So got to know him super well.
And but I assume all this time you're just, you know, absorbing all these different playing styles and the strategy. Like
absolutely. Because back then that was still when there weren't as many analytics as far as things that you can do yourself, not all the solvers and stuff.
It was mostly, this is my crew and this is how we think.
Right, yeah, like let's all look at someone's tournament history or something and we'll all just sit and talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, that it was a different approach to working on your game then. Like we still, you know, HUDs and stuff were still there, but you'd break down your HUD with other people and say like, oh man, how much should I be losing from the big blind? Or, you know, like what's your raise first in percentage from this and that? So, yeah, I mean, having three of the brightest minds in poker then. They were all amazing poker players then, you know, mm-hmm. let alone the way they are now.
There's a funny photo of you on Twitter with next to Stevie where you're wearing the same outfit. I don't know if you remember this.
Yes.
You're wearing the exact same outfit, and I think underneath there's a caption where you call yourself like Cheeseburger Stevie or something like that.
Yep.
Or...
yep. Older, fatter, and slower.
The two of you... I have lost your hair with some fierceness,
yes.
Might I say. I'm currently going through more of an Elio struggle myself and fighting against it. But definitely you guys, you know, it seemed like a quick transition. One day hair with the cap down, and then the next day, boom. Mr. Intimidation at the table.
I mean, I used to just wear a hat all the time because I was super nervous about it, and then – I decided that instead of being the wear the hat all the time guy, I would just, you know, fuck it. I'll just cut it off and see what it's like, you know.
It's definitely an intimidation thing. I don't know if you've noticed it since the change has happened.
Well, I mean, I looked a little more derpy with my hair, that's for sure. Also, the beard helps.
Yeah. So these days, when you're doing your studying, are you not bouncing it off of other players? Is it mostly just all at home and with your own data?
Certainly do a lot of discussion with other players, but it's a bit different because a lot of it is, you know, it's not necessarily going over a specific tournament. It's mm-hmm. more about, you know, looking at a subset of flops and ranges and trying to figure out, like talking with someone to figure out a way of, you know, what interactions mean something. So like what, you know, what blockers are important for certain bet sizes or bluffing, or like, you know, if I have this much range, what kind of c-betting size am I going to use? But you know, a lot more minute details than we were worried about then.
Right, and it's not like you're going to be able to get some brilliant mind in here who's going to look at the data and tell you something that you don't see yourself.
Right. Yeah, it's more about learning, like a figuring out a way to absorb all the information. It's like what's an easy, you know, heuristic to come up with these weird shaded solutions that I can't, you know, like no human's going to remember to like. Do this one thing 12% of the time. Like, what for each combo? I need to figure out like an easy rule to be like, okay, if I have like these certain hands, I want to bluff X percent. And so discussing that with other people, or like discussing why a specific subset of hands makes a great bluff, is very valuable too. Because you might not see that yourself looking at it. You know, you might not realize like, oh, what are these hands? What is so important about this? Why does it want to bluff with ace nine of spades and not these other hands?
Well, is talking poker with these other minds as fun as it was back in the day when you can just be like, yeah, I looked at him and I knew he didn't have it. So I put it in and you know what? He folded just like I thought. You know what I mean? Like, the conversations are different nowadays.
They definitely are. Although there's still some of that, you know, in the and when you're talking about live poker, because there's still so much exploitation and adjustment and stuff. Like, when you're talking about playing like a high stakes online tournament, yeah, it's a lot more cut and dry, you know, unless you just have like a random guy that's been going off for a bunch of buy-ins or something. Like, but when you're playing live poker, like, you go play like a $1,500 Venetian tournament, I mean, your opinion on the player means probably more than what the GTO solution to the hand is, you know.
Interesting. Like, so you're looking for more exploitative stuff.
Yes,
even
absolutely.
Even after looking at all the solvers and
I think that's the best. The best use for solvers is to find exploits. You get your solver. You try to approximate GTO as a baseline, but you need to keep in mind that like when you're looking at a solver, the solver output is the solver playing against the solver. So certain hands that are like bluff catching, say you like bet a river and a guy goes all in. Certain hands that seem like it's always bluff catching with, it's only doing that because it's also always bluffing with these other hands. And so if you think that this guy is, in particular, is not bluffing with this entire subset of hands that he should be, then that solution is worthless. You know, it's a great way to start, but you need to have it be affected by what you're observing.
And how many of these exploitative spots are you finding in the average 10K these days?
Quite a bit. I mean, there's just so many players. There's a lot of successful players that still don't look at solvers too. So I feel like it really depends upon the makeup of the field. If you go play like one of the Aria high rollers in the PokerGo studio, you know, for the most part, a lot of the players you're playing against are very studied. But if you go play like the 10K LAPC, I mean, it's still mostly exploitative play, even against other very good regulars. A lot of them just don't put that much stock in studying. Or at least in studying solver way. You know, I mean, I find it difficult to believe that people can win at a high rate in poker without doing some sort of studying. Not necessarily with solver work, but talking or what have you.
What do you make of Bryn Kenny, who says he's never even looked at a solver?
Ah, I mean, Bryn Kenny, he's a really good example because he doesn't study with a solver, but he also thinks about things critically and talks to people, you know, talks to his friends or, you know, breaks things down in a different way himself. You know, he's a perfect example of someone who learns through observation, because he plays with these guys that do work with solvers all the time, and Bryn is quick and sharp enough to figure out, you know, after he sees the way a hand's gone down, sees their two hands, he's like, okay, so if these two guys are using solvers all the time, they're probably saying this about you know, these strategies. So he can get that. He has some of that knowledge too, just from observing. Because he pretty much, I mean, 90% of these fields are guys that study solvers. So Bryn gets to see all that and play against the other people and, you know, try to adjust faster as he sees holes. And no one plays a perfect solver game.
I interviewed Mike Matisau for this podcast, and it's out right now for those of you listening. But one of the things he said during the interview was that GTO was for people with no talent.
Ah.
I was wondering, you know, let's talk about talent in the game. Do you think it's even necessary?
I don't even know how to define talent in poker. I mean, maybe if you have a talent for like
reading, I think when people hear talent, they think of like Stu Unger card sense, you know, that weird thing where you just kind of know, you know. I don't even know if it's real.
Yeah, I think it's like Stu, if you watched, I mean, you know, I don't know that much about him, but I've like, you know, read a little bit and seen some movies and stuff. Like, he seemed like he was on the streets and had like dealt with some pretty messed up stuff. So he probably got to be pretty good at like reading people. Like, people who are constantly in trouble get to know very well when like people's intentions and stuff by looking at them. And he also was a fantastic gin player, which means that his memory was, you know, he probably had like an Atlantic memory or something. Like, he, it, I feel like
is it that was, talent?
I guess, maybe. I mean, sure. That definitely is. I mean, especially for something like gin or like, you know, like chess. You know, like chess is another thing where it's like some people, all the chess players study a lot, but a lot of the best chess players are just something, you know, they just mm-hmm. picture things in a certain way and can remember moves in the board and, you know, see layouts differently than others. So I guess there but is
think,
a bit of
I think
of
what Mike's point was is that if you have no natural talent, whatever you believe that to be, solvers are a good way to play to form a winning strategy. However, exploitative play is always better if you can make the right play 100% of the time, which is impossible.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I think – but I still think that there's no – like there needs to be some sort of analytics. You know, like, yeah, GTO is definitely – it's not the most profitable way to play. It if you want to beat high-stakes online, like, heads-up cash games, I mean, you're going to need to study it because they're all going to be approximating it and or deviating a little bit to exploit mm-hmm. you specifically. But, you know, you're just going to need to know it to be able to battle their style. But I think that it just can't be argued that exploiting is going to make more because GTO, just by definition, is just – it's just not exploitable. It's not – but it's not the most profitable. It's just not going to lose money.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you're not shy about sharing your secrets and giving away the strategy. You're a coach for Run It Once, and you now have a new book, yes, Mastering indeed. Mixed Games by DMB Publishing. What made you write a mixed games book?
Well, it was kind of a funny thing. It was a project that fell into my lap, really. I was approached last year about it. And someone else had already started the project. David Macklin had, I guess, approached D&B Publishing about writing this book sometime, I believe, in 2017. And he had done, I don't know, approximately 20% of the book and then just kind of stopped talking to the publisher. He accepted part of the advance. And they'd pre-sold a bunch of copies of the book based on this. And I'm friends with Jonathan Little, and he approached me about finishing it. It wasn't something I ever would have thought of, first of all, because, I mean, I haven't written or done anything with speaking in a long time, you know, or like written language in a long time. But it seemed like it would be a fun project to take on. And mm-hmm. I thought that for something like this book, it's more targeted at getting people to learn mixed games. So I thought that it would be a fun challenge for myself. And I also, you know, like typically December, you know, January, February, like that winter time is not as busy of a time. I knew I had a few things I needed to do, like Five Diamond yeah. and the Poker Stars thing. But it just, it seemed like a fun challenge. It was like a derivative of my Run It Once stuff. And I've always learned a lot through coaching, you know, like I still work with Run It Once after all these years because I love the interaction. I feel like I get so much better the more that I talk about my own game. So I thought that this would be a good excuse for me to work on mixed myself and on the fundamentals while helping to grow the game without, you know, I mean, I'm not giving away the keys to the castle more or less. Like I don't think I can. It's too much in mixed is exploiting your table as well on a different level. But I talk about a good solid mathematical approach to the game, which will, you know, teach people a very good way to start, especially for a mixed environment that right now it's too expensive to learn how to play. Like you.
Right. There's the micro stakes online, which never run.
Yep.
And then there's high stakes.
Yeah. And then there's 4080 at Bellagio or Aria. And it's mm-hmm. most people can't afford to learn at 4080. I mean, that's a big loss ratio yeah. before you start winning. You know, and you can learn how to play a couple of the specific games, you know, at lower stakes. Some, you know, I mean, you can find like a 2-10 stud here or something, but it's difficult. And so my friends had always asked me, you know, how do you learn how to play all these games, and how do you, you know, and other than just sitting down with each one individually, I thought this would be a pretty good answer since that question.
Well, when
comes
did
up
you
so
get
much.
The? You obviously you said you started with stud and limit.
Yeah.
When did you decide to look into all the games?
So Full Tilt started doing 10 game tournaments and cash games, and I'd been playing horse tournaments online to teach myself how to play the split pot games for a long time. Mm-hmm. Also in Spokane, Washington, Omaha 8 or Better is a very popular game. So I had picked up one of the 2+2 books. I think like Razzie's split pot
yeah.
poker. Yeah. And learned that so that I could play those games when I was living in that area still. And so I'd always just kind of been into split pot poker because of that. And I started playing, you know, during Scoop and WCoop, there's these kind of mixed tournaments. So I started playing some of those. Then when 10 Game came out, I was staying with Steven Chidwick and Jim Colopy in Austria. And Stevie and I were just kind of sitting. We were just on a skiing trip, not really like doing that much poker, but he knew a lot about draw poker. So we just kind of decided that we wanted to learn more about all forms. So him and I just kind of collaborated and worked together on, you know, like I'd help him learn split pot poker and he'd help me learn draw poker. And so we just kind of both got into all of the games then, started playing like the 10 game there.
Did it feel like you were ahead of the curve?
I mean, I felt like...
now everyone seems like they're trying to branch out.
Right. I felt like I was ahead of the curve for like my peers, but there were still a lot of people like then, you know, all the full tilt pros were guys who've been playing these games forever. You know, they're playing nosebleeds and...
Yeah.
So, I mean, I felt like I was ahead of like our, you know, like we were ahead of, you know, our wave of poker, but not as far as, you know, these guys like Phil Ivey's stud ability or any of that stuff. It was just like, that seemed like mysticism almost, you know,
yeah.
It was like magic. Like, how are you so good at this? This is incredible.
Well, my favorite part of the book is the quizzes because it makes me realize how bad I am at each game when I make the wrong decision. You had the foreword written by Phil Hellmuth.
Yes.
How did you get that done?
The publisher has a good relationship with Phil. I mean, Phil and I have always, you know, we have the same relationship as most people that aren't very good friends with Phil at the poker table. We've had some really good conversations. And then, you know, Phil will also tell me how great he is and how I was trying to bluff it off into him. even now, you know. And so we've always...
Well, who's got the better of who in your encounters on the felt?
I mean, I think I've gotten the better of him... I guess. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can remember one specific hand from Five Diamond where not this last Five Diamond, but the one previously where Phil had lost heads up to Art Papazian in WPT in L.A. or Legends, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But there was like a very well publicized hand where Phil folds queens to a four bet jam.
Yes.
So
got a lot of grief over it.
Yes, exactly. So on our day two or day three table, I think day three table, he was seated on my right and I had a bunch of chips. And I ended up five bet jamming on him with ace four suited because it's like, I just thought, I mean, if he's folding queens and he's only calling with two hands, I have an ace in my hand, so.
And you showed it.
Yep. No, actually I did not show it. No.
Wow.
How
did you resist setting off a Hellmuth?
Because it was like, it was right before dinner break, so we still had another 4 hours to play, and I just would rather not. You know, it's like Phil didn't, at the time, Phil actually thought that I was Billy the Hat for most of the day. He kept calling me Billy, and he's like, oh yeah, I know you, you're blow up Billy. I'm like, no, no, Phil. So I just didn't want, you know, it's like, I don't know, whatever you think, if he thinks I'm this guy, that's cool. I'd rather not give him any information.
Yeah.
I really wanted to because my fiance told me, she's like, if you can make Phil swear at you in the blog today, then...
People take it like a badge of honor. It's like, finally, I induced a Hellmuth blow up.
It's not that hard. It just happens if you play with them enough.
That's what I'm saying. You don't really induce it. You just happen to be sitting there.
Yeah.
And circumstance will make it happen.
I mean, he went off on me this year when he limped in Omaha 8 and I isolated him with a hand and won like a couple of bets. It's like... Yeah, I was trying to bluff it off in slow motion, 40 bets deep.
They just trying to give it to me.
Yeah.
Honey, honey, they're trying to give it to me. So he wrote this up in Praised Your Limit Hold'em section. So those of you out there looking for a little Hellmuth words in the beginning won't be disappointed. What's your favorite mixed game to play? Do you have a preference one you're best at?
I like Omaha 8. I feel like... As far as tournaments, I think that I'm probably best at PL08, which is odd because I think that my tournament concepts help me in that more than necessarily mm-hmm. being very good at PL08. I'm very good at understanding the way ICM works, so that's super important in PL08 because just getting someone to fold when you guys are both like super even in equity.
Yeah, I remember talking to Jason Mercier about that a little bit. He's like, I was like trying to get some information out of him about why he was so good at PLO tournaments. And he was just like, forget the PLO part. I'm just good at tournaments.
Right, exactly. And in, especially in Omaha, in both forms of Omaha, it's super important to just like figure out a way to get someone to fold when they wouldn't in a cash game. Mm-hmm. I enjoy playing Omaha 8, I think, the most, just because it's a game where each table you play at, it's always different. You know, there's tons of open limping, tons of like three betting, multi-way pots. It's pretty fun. Action's pretty fast. Tables tend to be friendly and, yeah, you know, jovial. It's also, like I said, it was like one of the first split pot games I played. So it just kind of reminds me of playing in some of the dingy card rooms at home and, you know, having some beers with my friends trying to learn how to play.
Do you ever see a day when No Limit Hold'em isn't king?
No.
I don't think so.
Limit
Hold'em was king.
I know.
And Stud was king before that, and Draw was king before that.
What I heard was that Limit Hold'em became king because Action and No Limit Hold'em died, because all the bad players would just lose all their money all the time super fast. So, I mean, that could happen, but I think that now that No Limit's blown up this big and the main event is what it is, I think as long as the main event is what it is, No Limit will always be the king.
Yeah.
Because I guess the biggest Limit event used to be bigger than the main event, like at some point in time at the World Series. I don't know what year this was where it inflected that way, but...
Yeah, in the early 2000s, the opening event was always a Limit Hold'em event. It would always get like a crazy amount of people. And there used to be a 10K Limit event back in the 90s, I think. Anyway, I heard on a podcast that you were on that your apartment burned down and that you were wanted in Canada for it.
Yeah, sort of. my apartment burned down on my drive to Canada, and mm-hmm. they...
Are you sure?
Well,
you were nowhere in the vicinity.
Nowhere in the. I wasn't even in the country yet. But they basically they turned.
What
me
were
around.
All those oily rags in your trunk?
It would. I mean, if I would have owned it, maybe could have scammed some money at the time, since Full Tilt had just stolen all of my money.
Oh, that's why you're going to Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like a panic. Like I had 60K on Full Tilt, and I had like significantly less than 10K to my name otherwise. So it was like, oh my God, I'm going to be poor. I need to, you know, yeah. I need to get there and get my money back. And when I got to the border, I still had all my stuff for moving into my place for 6 months, but I just gotten a vacation rental with a friend and told them I was only going to be there a month and a half. And so they thought that I was trying to stay in the country illegally. Turned me around, had me get proof of tethering, which is like, that you plan on staying in the U.S., you have, like, reasons. So I own a piece of property in Idaho, and then I had to give them my income tax. And so all these things are like, oh, no, look, I'm planning on coming back someday.
Yeah.
And so then they begrudgingly let me in, but they stamped this gigantic thing that I had to, like, fold. It was, like, this piece of paper larger than the passport sheet that was like, you must exit or there will be a warrant issued for your arrest. So that was intense. And I still get a problem every time I go across the border. Although last time, like, I went to go play in Montreal, and they pulled me in the secondary. The guy's like, oh, what are you here for? Poker. He goes, oh, huh. What's all this stuff? And I kind of explained the story for a few minutes. He goes, you know, are there any satellites running still for this main event? Do you know what days they are? He just started asking me about the tournament. Okay. I guess
exactly.
I'm getting in.
Yeah. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
Obviously, after that, you moved to Mexico, live with Chidwick and Fox. Is it weird seeing those guys like on the high roller circuit doing their thing? Do you feel like that's something you want to do one day, aspire to be one of the super high roller people? I mean, you obviously have results in 25Ks. You finished fifth last year in a 25K in Florida.
Yeah, I think certainly I would like to play some of them, but I mean, first of all, they're both better than I am. So it's not weird that they're playing, you know, it's not weird to me that they're competing at a higher level. They spend more time studying and working on their game than I do. But also, I don't know. I've been in a sticky financial situation for years. I was backed for a very long time. It wasn't something I really thought about for a long time. It was like, I would rather just get to beat high stakes, be on my own, and then see how it goes. I don't know. I've never really wanted to like play Bobby's Room, for instance.
I only ask because there's some people who are so driven by success in poker that that's the end goal for them, to be at the top of the money list to play in the Super High Rollers or to get into Bobby's Room and Crush, whereas other ones are just like, hey, as long as I'm making a living and, you know, doing my job, then that's fine.
As long as I'm always improving, I'm happy with poker. I mean, sure, eventually I guess I could see myself trying to do that, but I also don't need the kind of stress that those financial swings bring. So I'd be happy, like, yeah, I like to play some 25Ks. I just like to play good tournaments. I don't really need to, like, travel as much and play, like, these, you know, like, I would have been mad if I went to the, like, BPO, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I like that they tried to do that, but those fields were really small and really bad.
Yeah.
You know, it was mostly all top players. I don't need to do that. You know, I mean, maybe, like, it would have been cool to play in the Super High Roller Bowl the way that it was before. We'll see if it comes back to being as big and, you know, full. Like, something like that would be a lot of fun, or playing, like, you know, one drop or a Triton. Sure. But I don't want to go and grind, like, the 100K circuit. I think that that's – it's too much stress for me. I don't – with, you know, my soon-to-be wife here and our house and our pets and stuff, I don't want to be away enough. I'm happy on my own road to improvement, I guess. You know, I'd like to be able to beat those fields for sure. But I don't necessarily want that to be my full-time thing, is to play those. I think it's just too—it's too much up and down. I don't know. I don't need it.
Well, speaking of money, $1.6 million after last December's win in the WPT Five Diamond World Poker Classic. I think you beat out like 1,000 people or something like that for that one. Is that life-changing at that point in your career, or is it just...
Absolutely life-changing. I like I said, I was backed. And so I didn't have all of myself in it, but it made it so that I was able to gamble on my own for the first time in a really long time. I gave away my initial bankroll before Black Friday, when my mom's company went bankrupt and was in like $2 million of debt. So I bailed. I spent all the money I had to bail her out at the time and help with things. And so then I got backed and was backed from then ever since. So it was it was a different moment for me. Mm-hmm. I, you know, made a good living from poker and always been comfortable. I wasn't like a starving backed player, but it was, you know, it's different. It was weird thinking about it. It was like, it's been a long time since I've gambled with purely my own money. So it was huge for me. I mean, obviously it was one of the biggest tournaments of the year and the largest WPT, I think, ever, even though first place was smaller this year than the year before. Somehow.
Payouts are getting flatter.
I know.
Well, what's the most fun, expensive, or ridiculous thing you did with the money?
I mean, I bought a house. We didn't do
ridiculous.
Anything.
Ridiculous.
It's kind of funny. We probably one of the most ridiculous things we've done was before winning. We went to Noma in Tulum, and that was like $1,500 a person.
That sounds like an experience.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, we haven't done anything insane. We're planning our honeymoon for January, which we'll be going to like Thailand, Vietnam, Japan, and Korea. So
what's your life leak when it's not gambling?
I mean, food, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I spend a lot of money going out to eat.
You're in the right city for it.
Like, beer a lot. Yeah, beer, weed, food, video games. That's pretty much it. Nothing super expensive.
Yeah,
you know?
Those are all very cheap.
Yeah.
A lot of teenagers can get most of that
stuff. Yeah. I mean, food can be real expensive.
Yeah, it's true.
You know?
But some of the best food is also the cheapest.
Like, Oh, yeah. Especially here in Vegas. You can find some great hole-in-the-wall places that have.
Yeah.
You guys are super close to Mochico Chicken, which is like one of my favorite spots.
Mochico, yeah. Yeah, what's your mindset after firing 4 bullets in a 10K? And how do you convince yourself to keep firing the 5th bullet? Because for those that don't know, you were into that tournament at Bellagio for 50K.
Yep.
So, yeah, I would think after a couple bullets, I wouldn't be in the right mental state to keep playing.
After number 3, where I just savagely bluffed it off instantly. I mean, it was like I probably played for like 30 minutes and just barreled it off. I was like, oh, man, I texted Elio Fox and I said, you know, should I re-enter again? And he asked me if I was out of my mind. So then I went and got some money from him, entered.
Well, what a good friend to say that you're out of your mind and still come up with it.
No, he was, are you out of your mind thinking about not reentering?
Oh.
No, not.
Here am I thinking, thinking Ellie is the voice of reason, and it wasn't even close.
No, he is the voice of reason. He was like, what, do you hate money? Like, what are you doing? Of course you're reentering this tournament. It's mm-hmm. incredible. So I went and got some money from him, entered again, and then when I busted the fourth time, I only had like $9,800 and it was $10,400 on me, but I didn't want to go borrow money from somebody. So I actually went to the ATM and paid like this ridiculous like $20 or $15 fee, whatever they charge, mm-hmm. to withdraw the other amount from my account to go enter rather than borrowing it from someone to save myself the $20 and just kind of slunk over to the thing and registered the fifth time.
Hey, like, this is the final bullet.
Yeah. Well, it had to be because it was only like 30 minutes before the registration was closed.
Oh, you did it before.
But you never know. You never know. I actually ended up that bullet. I got sat at a table with Milo Skirbic, who I ended up getting heads up with on – yeah, that was day two, which was pretty funny. We actually were friends. We just started talking at that table. We had some good mutual friends. And then we were just like talking to each other the whole way through the tournament and then ended up getting heads up, which was cool.
Well, maybe he thinks of you differently than you think of him.
Yeah.
Longest session?
Not super long, probably like 20 hours.
20?
Yeah, I'm not a big like –
do you remember the end of the session? Were you making mistakes or was it just like the game died?
I'm sure I was making mistakes. I'm a terrible tired player. This was like in Pendleton, Oregon, I believe.
Wild Horse?
Wild Horse.
Yeah.
Exactly. My first live tournament series.
Biggest pot you've ever won or lost?
In cash, I'm assuming you're talking
or
about?
Or equity in tournament.
Oh. Equity in tournament would be PCA final table.
That's right. What'd you finish?
I got eighth.
Eighth? Okay.
Yeah. Huge flip against Kevin Schultz for like probably 40% of the chips in play eight-handed. So that was, yeah.
Did not go your way.
No. That was
how do you get over that one?
Rough one. 30 minutes of crying in the hallway by myself.
Really?
And then, yeah, it was rough. Before that point in time, I had accumulated about $5 million in cashes online without ever final tabling a tournament with 100K for first place. So this was like the
That's
first...
That's called grinding.
Yeah, super grinding. And just like, you know, I was friends with a lot of wildly successful poker players. So I kind of felt like cursed and I don't know, you know. My headspace wasn't as healthy then either. So things were like either really good or really bad.
Let's see. That was for 141,000, so... Yeah.
Yeah, that was my biggest and worst score.
Yeah, I could imagine that one being bittersweet. Mm-hmm. Best swap or piece you've ever had of anybody?
Kevin McPhee. And, I had a piece of a World Series main event final tables too, but he got seventh. So I think Kevin McPhee, I swapped with him in both the 5K bracelet event that he won, and then at World Series Europe main event
nice.
That he won like a month later.
Very, very nice.
Yeah.
Way to go, Kevin.
Yeah. I had a few years of being like the swap pro. It was great.
Oh, you kept picking the right people?
Yep. Just kept doing it. And like the tournaments that I would do well in, for some reason, I just didn't have swaps.
Should have swapped.
I know.
Weirdest place you've ever played poker for money?
I've played online from Moldova, which is probably the strangest place. Like, lived there for a month. That was really odd. Played Scoop.
What was so odd about that?
Because Moldova is a former Soviet republic, but also not part of the EU. So it's like we were in the like Chisinau area, which still has a lot of damage from like I think World War II. Like a lot of buildings still like bombed and broken.
Yeah.
It just was a different world. Like, I'd been to different kinds of underprivileged or, like, poor countries, but I hadn't been to one like that, like a former Soviet bloc country.
Yeah.
So it felt pretty alien. And the schedule was terrible because it was before Scoop was two-day events. So I can remember, like, I got, like, 14th or something in the warm-up, and it started at, like, 1 p.m., and I busted at, like, 3 p.m. So I guess maybe that was my longest session now that I think about it.
Yeah, online's different.
Yeah.
It's you're just, in your underwear. You can get up and go to the bathroom and bring the laptop with you.
Especially playing from Europe where you don't, you know, it's like you start in the afternoon and so it doesn't even really.
Yeah, that's
your day isn't feeling. Syncopated the right way. Yeah, you don't know what's going on.
Up all night, sleep all morning.
Yeah.
Best player we've never heard of. Or just somebody who's underappreciated that needs more love.
A lot of underappreciated players. Underappreciated? I mean, I think James Romero is underappreciated. Like, he's definitely had some success, but at the
did
same
he win
time,
the exact
like,
same tournament you did.
He did, yeah. Which is yeah. That's funny. I didn't think about that. Yeah, but he works super hard and just like does really well. But there's not, I don't know. You don't see his name everywhere.
Yeah. Shout out to James, WPT champion himself. Biggest poker regret. So obviously, as much as you like to regret putting it into the PCA there and losing that flip, it's not really a regret.
Nah, I'd still do it.
Yeah.
Biggest poker regret?
Do you have a hand where you zigged instead of zagged?
Not really. I mean,
nothing haunts you?
Specific hands, no, not really. You know, there's like runouts I can think of that haunt me, but not, you know, nothing like that. I think my biggest regret was probably not being more aggressive early on in poker. And being too conservative, like not just playing higher and like really pushing it when poker was so good.
Mm-hmm.
And playing too many tables online, I think. I think I really stunted my growth for a period of years by just trying to maximize the number of tournaments I'm firing rather than maximizing my improvement trajectory.
Did it make you more robotic instead of...
Yeah, I was just a really tight, like predictable, solid player, you know, with good results, but just like a, you know...
Well, that's how you beat eight tables at once.
Yeah, 25 tables at once. Yeah. There was a point where I was playing like 18 to 20 on a, like your laptop, like a touchpad laptop.
No external monitor?
No.
That's crazy.
Awful.
What was your worst job before poker?
I was an incoming call receiver for Ameritech.
That already sounds awful. I don't know what it is, and I don't want to do it.
It was like 4 days a week of 4 a.m. till 6 p.m.
And what are people calling about?
Their phone service. So it's like a, like AT&T customer service, but like for landlines. And so your job was to not only deal with their problems, but then you got to try to upsell them on stuff. So they're calling you because they're angry, but then you got to try to sell them something afterwards. And man, if you didn't try to sell people things, you were in trouble.
Were you good at it?
I was okay at it. Because I figured out a way to game the system. There's a bunch of stuff you can give people for free, and you still got commission if you gave it to them for free. So then I would just keep talking at them real fast about stuff until they're like, fine, I'll take that.
Yeah.
And then they just take the free
win.
Stuff. Yeah.
What was your largest non-poker wager? We mentioned that you were already a video game horse, but what about other prop bets?
Probably in bowling. That same summer when we were playing a bunch of Super Smash Brothers, I was wagering against my friends playing bowling, and I think – I mean, then I really haven't gambled that much on other things besides poker. I think, like, there were some games where I'd bet, like, up to $500, but that was only because I was winning. I was too broke then to bet that much, at least in my mind. So, yeah, I mean, nothing huge. Probably, like, you know, $500 to $1,000 on bowling. And not because I'm a great bowler, but because of handicapping and bowling, you know.
Oh, they gave you pins or something?
Yeah. They were both, like, volatile bowlers who could bowl, like, really high. Because I had both like a curve, you know, I just am a straight ahead bowler, but I bowl very consistently.
Give me that lane ball with no balancing issues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just, you know, I get a split a lot, but, you know, I get a spare or a strike.
There you go. What is a talent you don't have that you wish you did?
I wish I could brew my own beer. I think that almost might be cheating because I like to cook a lot and I feel like I'm a fairly good cook. But
you want to be a brewmaster?
I do want to be a brewmaster.
Just to save the money?
No, just to like make my own because I like weird beers so much. I would love to do it.
You can't myself. Call your beer the Dylan because that's already your boat's name.
Right? Yeah. Well, Dylan 2 okay. Or 3 or like the Dylan Mark 5. You know, we could.
Here I am on my Dylan. I'm drinking a Dylan 2.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm wearing the Dylan 3 outfit that I designed myself. This is my dog, Dylan 4.
Oh, man. If it gets to that level, I think Alyssa would just leave me.
Who are the five greatest rappers of all time? Dylan. That is a reference that I'm sure that most people won't get.
That is actually my my black chip poker screen name. It's
five, oh, really?
Best, five best rappers. Yeah.
That's pretty good. we'll cut that out. Headphones on at the table, yes or no?
Yes, but I'm not always listening to them.
Okay. It's a fake out move.
Yeah, sometimes it's just.
You mean they're really low or off?
Just off a lot of times.
Is it like a please don't talk to me move, or is it a I want to be able to listen to you without you thinking I am?
No, it's more of a I wear them when I just am not really into socializing that day.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, I'm a pretty big socializer at the table, and I do have music on often. Usually it's just kind of like a lo-fi, you know, nothing, not a lot of like lyric stuff when I'm playing.
How about that? What kind of music? So mostly instrumental?
Yeah. Mostly like lo-fi hip-hop kind of stuff. I sometimes, you know, like on breaks and stuff, I'll listen to, you know, like real hip-hop or like electronic music to kind of get myself in whatever
pump up
mood
music.
I need. Yeah, I either get pumped up or to
slow
get
down.
Less pumped up. Yeah, exactly. Depending on how it's going.
Favorite album?
Probably Liquid Swords by the RZA and the GZA.
Okay.
Wu-Tang Clan.
You strike me as a Wu-Tang guy, just looking at you. Is that, you're just a hardcore rap guy?
Yeah. Early rap. Some of the newer stuff, you know, like I like Chance the Rapper a lot. I think he feels a lot to me kind of like old school rappers.
You can't get in the mumblecore? Mm-hmm.
No. And like Migos, I mean, it's like, I don't know. Some things, you know, I mean, occasionally something like catches my ear.
But. Do you ever, okay, so I'm feeling this way at 35, where like I'll listen to something new out and I'll just be like, nope, I don't like this. But do I not like it because I'm 35 and I'm old now? Or is it just bad? I don't know.
Yep.
Like in your brain, you're like, okay, Migos. But like how much of you is like, maybe I'm just old?
That was one of the first, like, their music was one of the first things I felt that way about, because it was like, man, this is just so popular. But then I listened to this great interview with Snoop Dogg where he talks about they, like, wanted him to do a thing, and he's like, nah, I'm not doing that. It all just sounds like, and he just had this great, like, facsimile. He's like, they all sound exactly like this, mm-hmm. and went off about it. It's like, yeah, that is true. They're just kind of, I don't know.
All right, well, if they're not cool for Snoop, then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there we go.
Favorite movie?
He is old. Ooh, Big Lebowski.
The Big Lebowski, okay. The Dude Abides.
Yes, indeed.
We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator.
Oh, dear.
So give me a number between 1 and 8.
6.
Okay. What question would you most like to know the answer to? What would be the most profitable question to know the answer to?
The most profitable question to know the answer to?
Or valuable, I should say.
Probably how to solve the energy crisis.
That would make you very rich.
Yes. And it would, because the other thing I was thinking of was, are we, like, you know, how long will our planet survive? I thought would be another question I'd like to know the answer to. Not that it causes me immediate stress, because it's certainly I'm not going to.
Well, along the same lines, is there an afterlife? If you definitively knew, that would change the world like crazy.
Well, especially if you definitively knew yes.
Or, yeah.
You know, like definitively knew no, it might not change your decision making as much.
It would change policy all over the world.
That's true.
Well, you'd have to be able to share it with everyone.
Yeah, you have to be able to prove it. Because if you just, like, if you knew that, like, some voice appeared and was like, this is the absolute truth, and you knew that it was, but then you just couldn't, I mean, you tell people how they'd be
then,
like,
then all of a sudden you're the crazy guy on the street.
Idiot.
I was kidnapped by aliens. Might as well be saying that.
Exactly. Then it'd probably be the worst answer you ever received, because you knew for sure it'd be the truth.
I like your answer with energy better. More practical, and it saves the surprise for later.
And you'd be the first trillionaire.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, if you had clean, sustainable energy, is your answer?
Who needs a trillion, though?
Yeah. I mean,
just give me 100 billion and we'll be fine.
Yeah.
That's where I cap out at.
I don't need the Bezos planet yacht thing that he has. I mean, you know.
Although, who knows? We might be looking at, you know, maybe he'll be able to get off the planet in time.
That's true. Yeah.
He'll be able to go to Bezos' planet, Bezos number 4 on his Bezos rocket ship.
That's right. Yeah, as soon as they'll probably be start selling off the moons of Jupiter or something, and you know, each billionaire will have their own.
You got land in Idaho. Why not get some land
in space?
In space.
I mean, there's some asteroids out there that are, you know, made of like solid gold or close to solid gold, more gold than it's on our entire planet. Just get one of those. Be okay.
What if one of those hit our planet?
Then we wouldn't care about how
we
much
gold was
in it.
We wouldn't care about gold anymore.
That's right. Wouldn't care about it much of anything.
Man.
Except for the few minutes of...
Now I'm praying for an asteroid. Dylan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man.
That's it. That's the show. Thank you once again to Dylan for coming on the podcast and for sharing the stories. You can go follow him on Twitter at Dylan Lindy, and you can do the same for us at Card Player Media and at poker_stories. You can find more from Dylan at Run It Once, and also make sure you check out his new book, Mastering Mixed Games. If this was your first Poker Stories podcast listen, then please subscribe. Leave a rating and a review and let us know about it with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll hook you up with a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.